March 15, 1906. Monday, March 5, 1906, Mr. Clemens talks to the West Side Young Men's Christian Association in the Majestic Theater. Miss Lyon meets one of the Christian young men at the door. Patrick's funeral. Luncheon next day at the Hartford Club. Mr. Clemens meets 11 of his old friends. They tell many stories. Reverend Dr. McKnight and the Jersey funeral. Mr. Twitchell's story on board the Kanawha about Richard Croker's father. The Mary Ann story. Decoration Day and the fiery major and Mr. Twitchell's interrupted prayer. Police hustle crowd awaiting Mark Twain. Bungle at the Majestic Theater angers YMCA men. Wouldn't open the doors. Mr. Clemens gives some advice about the treatment of corporations and talks about gentlemen. Members of the West Side branch of the Young Men's Christian Association found that entering the Majestic Theater yesterday afternoon to hear an address by Mark Twain had a close resemblance to a football match. No one was injured, but for a few minutes the police were hustling the crowd backward and forward by sheer force. A mounted man was sent to push his way through the thickest of the press, and the jam was perilous. The doors of the theater should have been opened at 3 o'clock, and about 300 persons were there at that time. It was an orderly crowd of young men with a sprinkling of elderly ones, but Captain Daly of the West 47th Street Station would not allow them to be admitted until he had summoned the reserves. It took 20 minutes for these to arrive, and every moment the crush grew greater. Still, there was no disorder, and the police, as they formed into line, had to face nothing more dangerous than a little good-humored chaff. The crowd was ranged in a rough column facing the main doors of the lobby. The Young Men's Christian Association authorities came out several times and asked the captain to allow the doors to be opened. "If you do it, I'll take away my men and there'll be a lot of people hurt or killed," he replied. "I know how to handle crowds." Then he proceeded to handle the crowds. He tried to swing the long, solid line up against the southwestern side of Columbus Circle and force them in by the side entrance of the lobby instead of the one they faced. First he sent a mounted man right through the column. The patrolman followed, and in a moment the orderly gathering was hustled and thrust in all directions. Captain Daly's next maneuver was to open the side door. The crowd surged up, but he had them pushed back and closed the door again. The crowd was utterly bewildered. Then the Young Men's Christian Association authorities opened one half of the door on their own responsibility. Through this narrow passage, the crowd squeezed. The plate glass in the half that was closed was shattered to atoms, and the men surged forward. A few coats were torn, but in spite of the way in which they had been handled, everybody kept his temper. If there had been any disorderly element present, nothing could have avoided serious accidents. In the end, all but 500 gained admission. Hold police responsible. At the opening of the meeting, the Reverend Dr. Charles P. Fagnani, the chairman, said, "The management desires to disclaim all responsibility for what has happened." Cheers. "The matter was taken out of their hands by the police." Hisses. "We wanted to open the doors earlier, but our lords and masters, the police, took the matter into their own hands and settled it in their own way." Hisses. "You have been accustomed long enough to being brutally treated by the police, and I do not see why you should mind it." A voice. "You're right." "Some day you will take matters into your own hands and will decide that the police shall be the servants of the citizens." At the end of the meeting, Charles F. Polanson, secretary of the West Side branch, stated he had been asked to submit a resolution condemning the action of the police, but it has been decided it was better not to do so. Mark Twain was introduced as a man well worth being clubbed to hear. He was greeted with a storm of applause that lasted over a minute. "I thank you for this signal recognition of merit," he said. "I have been listening to what has been said about citizenship. You complain of the police. You created the police. You are responsible for the police. They must reflect you, their masters. Consider that before you blame them. Citizenship is of the first importance in a land where a body of citizens can change the whole atmosphere of politics, as has been done in Philadelphia. There is less graft there than there used to be. I was going to move to Philadelphia, but it is no place for enterprise now." Dr. Russell spoke of organization. "I was an organization once, myself, for 12 hours, and accomplished things I could never have done otherwise. When they say step lively, remember it is not an insult from a conductor to you personally, but from the president of the road to you, an embodiment of American citizenship. When the insult is flung at your old mother and father, it shows the meanness of the omnipotent president, who could stop it if he would. Mark Twain got the stateroom. I was an organization once. I was traveling from Chicago with my publisher and stenographer. I always travel with a bodyguard. And engaged a stateroom on a certain train. For above all its other conveniences, the stateroom gives the privilege of smoking. When we arrived at the station, the conductor told us he was sorry the car with our stateroom was left off. I said, "You are under contract to furnish a stateroom on this train. I am in no hurry. I can stay here a week at the road's expense. It'll have to pay my expenses and a little over." Then the conductor called a grandee, and after some argument, he went and bundled some meek people out of the stateroom, told them something not strictly true, and gave it me. About 11 o'clock, the conductor looked in on me and was very kind and winning. He told me he knew my father-in-law. It was much more respectable to know my father-in-law than me in those days. Then he developed his game. He was very sorry the car was only going to Harrisburg. They had telegraphed to Harrisburg, Pittsburgh, San Francisco, and couldn't get another car. He threw himself on my mercy, but to him I only replied, "Then you had better buy the car." I had forgotten all about this. When some time after, Mr. Thompson of the Pennsylvania heard I was going to Chicago again and wired, "I am sending my private car. Clemens cannot ride on an ordinary car. He costs too much." Yesterday in the afternoon, I talked to the West Side Young Men's Christian Association in the Majestic Theater. The audience was to have been restricted to the membership, or at least to the membership's sex, but I had asked for a couple of stage boxes and had invited friends of mine of both sexes to occupy them. There was trouble out at the doors, and I became afraid that these friends would not get in. Miss Lyon volunteered to go out and see if she could find them and rescue them from the crowd. She was a pretty small person for such a service, but maybe her lack of dimensions was in her favor rather than against it. She plowed her way through the incoming masculine wave and arrived outside, where she captured the friends and also had an adventure. Just as the police were closing the doors of the theater and announcing to the crowd that the place was full and no more could be admitted, a flushed and excited man crowded his way to the door and got as much as his nose in, but there the officer closed the door and the man was outside. He and Miss Lyon were for the moment the center of attention, she because of her solitariness in that sea of masculinity, and he because he had been defeated before folks, a thing which we all enjoy, even when we are West Side Young Christians and ought to let on that we don't. The man looked down at Miss Lyon, anybody can do that without standing on a chair, and he began pathetically, I say began pathetically, the pathos of his manner and his words was confined to his beginning. He began on Miss Lyon, then shifted to the crowd for a finish. He said, "I have been a member of this West Side Young Men's Christian Association in good standing for 7 years, and have always done the best I could, yet never once got any reward." He paused half an instant, shot a bitter glance at the closed door, and added with deep feeling, "It's just my goddamned luck." I think it damaged my speech for Miss Lyon. The speech was well enough, certainly better than the report of it in the papers. But in spite of her compliments, I knew there was nothing in it as good as what she had heard outside, and by the delight which she exhibited in that outsider's eloquence, I knew that she knew it. I will insert here a passage from the newspaper report because it refers to Patrick. Definition of a gentleman. Mark Twain went on to speak of the man who left $10,000 to disseminate his definition of a gentleman. He denied that he had ever defined one, but said if he did, he would include the mercifulness, fidelity, and justice the scripture read at the meeting spoke of. He produced a letter from William Dean Howells and said, "He writes he is just 69, but I have known him longer than that. I was born to be afraid of dying, not of getting old," he says. "Well, I'm the other way. It's terrible getting old. You gradually lose your faculties and fascinations and become troublesome. People try to make you think you are not. But I know I'm troublesome." Then he says no part of life is so enjoyable as the eighth decade. "That's true. I've just turned it, and I enjoy it very much. If old men were not so ridiculous..." Why didn't he speak for himself? "But," he goes on, "they are ridiculous, and they are ugly. I never saw a letter with so many errors in it. Ugly. I was never ugly in my life. 40 years ago, I was not so good-looking. The looking-glass then lasted me 3 months. Now I can wear it out in 2 days. You've been up in Hartford burying poor old Patrick. I suppose he was old, too, says Mr. Howells. No, he was not old. Patrick came to us 36 years ago, a brisk, lithe young Irishman. He was as beautiful in his graces as he was in his spirit, and he was as honest a man as ever lived. For 25 years he was our coachman, and if I were going to describe a gentleman in detail, I would describe Patrick. At my own request, I was his pallbearer with our old gardener. He drove me and my bride so long ago. As the little children came along, he drove them too. He was all the world to them, and for all in my house he had the same feelings of honor, honesty, and affection. He was 60 years old, 10 years younger than I. Howells suggests he was old. He was not so old. He had the same gracious and winning ways to the end. Patrick was a gentleman, and to him I would apply the lines, "So may I be courteous to men, faithful to friends, true to my God, a fragrance in the path I trod." At the funeral, I saw Patrick's family. I had seen no member of it for a good many years. The children were men and women. When I had seen them last, they were little creatures. So far as I could remember, I had not seen them since, as little chaps, they joined with ours, and with the children of the neighbors, in celebrating Christmas Eve around a Christmas tree in our house, on which occasion Patrick came down the chimney, apparently, disguised as St. Nicholas, and performed the part to the admiration of the little and the big alike. John, our old gardener, was a fellow pallbearer with me. The rest were Irish coachmen and laborers, old friends of Patrick. The cathedral was half filled with people. I spent the night at Twitchell's house that night, and at noon next day at the Hartford Club, I met at a luncheon 11 of my oldest friends, Charlie Clark, editor of The Current, Judge Hammersley of the Supreme Court, Colonel Cheney, Sam Dunham, Twitchell, Dr. Reverend Parker, Charles E. Perkins, Archie Welch. A deal of pretty jolly reminiscing was done, interspersed with mournings over beloved members of the old comradeship whose names have long ago been carved upon their gravestones. The Reverend Dr. McKnight was one of these. He was a most delightful man, and in his day he was almost a rival of Twitchell in the matter of having adventures. Once when he was serving professionally in New York, a new widower came and begged him to come over to a Jersey town and conduct the funeral of his wife. McKnight consented, but said he should be very uneasy if there should be any delay, because he must be back in New York at a certain hour to officiate at a funeral in his own church. He went over to that Jersey town, and when the family and friends were all gathered together in the parlor, he rose behind the coffin, put up his hands in the solemn silence, and said, "Let us pray." There was a twitch at his coattail, and he bent down to get the message. The widower whispered and said, "Not yet, not yet. Wait a little." McKnight waited a little. Then, remembering the time was passing, and he must not miss his train and the other funeral, he rose again, put up his hands, and said, "Let us pray." There was another twitch at his coattail. He bent down and got the same message. "Not yet, not yet. Wait a little." He waited, became uneasier than ever, got up the third time, put up his hands, and got another twitch. This time, when he bent down, the man explained. He whispered, "Wait a little. She's not all here. Stomach's at the apothecary's." Several things were told on Twitchell, illustrative of his wide catholicity of feeling and conduct, and I was able to furnish something in this line myself. 3 or 4 years ago, when Sir Thomas Lipton came over here to race for the America Cup, I was invited to go with Mr. Rogers and half a dozen other worldlings in Mr. Rogers' yacht, the Kanawha, to see the race. Mr. Rogers is fond of Twitchell and wanted to invite him to go also, but was afraid to do it because he thought Twitchell would be uncomfortable among those worldlings. I said I didn't think that would be the case. I said Twitchell was chaplain in a fighting brigade all through the Civil War, and was necessarily familiar with about all the different kinds of worldlings that could be started. So Mr. Rogers told me, though with many misgivings, to invite him, and that he would do his best to see that the worldlings should modify their worldliness and pay proper respect and deference to Twitchell's cloth. When Twitchell and I arrived at the pier at 8 in the morning, the launch was waiting for us. All the others were on board. The yacht was anchored out there, ready to sail. Twitchell and I went aboard and descended to the little drawing room on the upper deck. The door stood open, and as we approached, we heard hilarious laughter and talk proceeding from that place, and I recognized that the worldlings were having a worldly good time. But as Twitchell appeared in the door, all that hilarity ceased as suddenly as if it had been shut off with an electric button, and the gay faces of the worldlings at once put on a most proper and impressive solemnity. The last word we had heard from these people was the name of Richard Croker, the celebrated Tammany leader, all-round blatherskite and chief pillager of the municipal till. Twitchell shook hands all around and broke out with, "I heard you mention Richard Croker. I knew his father very well indeed. He was head teamster in our brigade in the Civil War, the Sickles Brigade. A fine man, as fine a man as a person would want to know. He was always splashed over with mud, of course, but that didn't matter. The man inside the muddy clothes was a whole man, and he was educated. He was highly educated. He was a man who had read a great deal, and he was a Greek scholar, not a mere surface scholar, but a real one. He used to read aloud from his Greek Testament, and when he hadn't it handy, he could recite from it from memory. And he did it well, and with spirit. Presently, I was delighted to see that every now and then he would come over of a Sunday morning and sit under the trees in our camp with our boys and listen to my ministrations. I couldn't refrain from introducing myself to him. That is, I couldn't refrain from speaking to him about this, and I said, 'Mr. Croker, I want to tell you what a pleasure it is to see you come and sit with my boys and listen to me. For I know what it must cost you to do this, and I want to express my admiration for a man who can put aside his religious prejudices and manifest the breadth and tolerance that you have manifested.' He flushed and said with eloquent emphasis, 'Mr. Twitchell, do you take me for a goddamned papist?' Mr. Rogers said to me, aside, 'This relieves me from my burden of uneasiness.'" Twitchell, with his big heart, his wide sympathies, and his limitless benignities and charities and generosities, is the kind of person that people of all ages and both sexes fly to for consolation and help in time of trouble. He is always being levied upon by this kind of persons. Years ago, many years ago, a soft-headed young donkey who had been reared under Mr. Twitchell's spiritual ministrations sought a private interview, a very private interview with him, and said, "Mr. Twitchell, I wish you would give me some advice. It is a very important matter with me that lies near my heart, and I want to proceed wisely. Now, it is like this. I have been down to the Bermudas on the first vacation I have ever had in my life, and there I met a most charming young lady, native of that place, and I fell in love with her, Mr. Twitchell. I fell in love with her, oh, so deeply. Well, I can't describe it, Mr. Twitchell, I can't describe it. I have never had such feelings before, and they just consume me. They burn me up. When I got back here, I found I couldn't think of anybody but that girl. I wanted to write to her, but I was afraid. I was afraid. It seemed too bold. I ought to have taken advice, perhaps, but really I was not myself. I had to write. I couldn't help it. So I wrote to her. I wrote to her as guardedly as my feelings would allow, but I had the sense all the time that I was too bold. I was too bold. She wouldn't like it. Sometimes I would almost think maybe she would answer, but then there would come a colder wave, and I would say, 'No, I shall never hear from her. She will be offended.' But at last, Mr. Twitchell, a letter has come. I don't know how to contain myself. I want to write again, but I may spoil it. I may spoil it, and I want your advice. Tell me if I had better venture. Now, here she has written. Here is her letter, Mr. Twitchell. She says this. She says, 'You say in your letter you wish it could be your privilege to see me half your time. How would you like it to see me all the time?' What do you think of that, Mr. Twitchell? How does that strike you? Do you think she is not offended? Do you think that that indicates a sort of a shadowy leaning toward me? Do you think it, Mr. Twitchell? Could you say that?" "Well," Twitchell said, "I would not like to be too sanguine. I would not like to commit myself too far. I would not like to put hopes into your mind which could fail of fruition. But on the whole, daring is a good thing in these cases. Sometimes daring, a bold front, will accomplish things that timidity would fail to accomplish. I think I would write her, guardedly, of course, but write her. Oh, Mr. Twitchell, oh, you don't know how happy you do make me. I'll write her right away, but I'll be guarded. I'll be careful, careful." Twitchell read the rest of the letter, saw that this girl was just simply throwing herself at this young fellow's head, and was going to capture him by fair means or foul, but capture him. But he sent the young fellow away to write the guarded letter. In due time he came with the girl's second letter and said, "Mr. Twitchell, will you read that? Now read that. How does that strike you? Is she kind of leaning my way? I wish you could say so, Mr. Twitchell. You see there what she says. She says, 'You offered to send me a present of a ring.' I did it, Mr. Twitchell. I declare it was a bold thing, but I couldn't help it. I did that intrepid thing. And that is what she says. 'You offered to send me a ring. But my father is going to take a little vacation excursion in the New England States, and he is going to let me go with him. If you should send the ring here, it might get lost. We shall be in Hartford a day or two. Won't it be safer to wait till then, and you put it on my finger yourself?' What do you think of that, Mr. Twitchell? How does it strike you? Is she leaning? Is she leaning?" "Well," Twitchell said, "I don't know about that. I must not be intemperate. I must not say things too strongly, for I might be making a mistake. But I think, on the whole, I think she is leaning. I do. I think she is leaning." "Oh, Mr. Twitchell, it does my heart so much good to hear you say that. Mr. Twitchell, if there was anything I could do to show my gratitude for those words, well, you see the condition I am in, and to have you say that..." Twitchell said, "Now, wait a minute. Now, let's not make any mistake here. Don't you know that this is a most serious position? It can have the most serious results upon two lives. You know there is such a thing as a mere passing fancy that sets a person's soul on fire for the moment. That person thinks it is love, and that it is permanent love, that it is real love. Then he finds out by and by that it was but a momentary insane passion. And then perhaps he has committed himself for life, and he wishes he was out of that predicament. Now let us make sure of this thing. I believe that if you try and conduct yourself wisely and cautiously, I don't feel sure, but I believe that if you conduct yourself wisely and cautiously, you can beguile that girl into marrying you." "Oh, Mr. Twitchell, I can't express..." "Well, never mind expressing anything. What I am coming at is this. Let us make sure of our position. If this is real love, go ahead. If it is nothing but a passing fancy, drop it right here for both your sakes. Now tell me, is it real love? If it is real love, how do you arrive at that conclusion? Have you some way of proving to your entire satisfaction that this is real, genuine, lasting, permanent love?" "Mr. Twitchell, I can tell you this. You can just judge for yourself. From the time that I was a baby in the cradle up, Mr. Twitchell, I have had to sleep close to my mother, with a door open between, because I have always been subject to the most horrible nightmares. And when they break out, my mother has to come running from her bed and appease me and comfort me and pacify me. Now then, Mr. Twitchell, from the cradle up, whenever I got hit with those nightmare convulsions, I have always sung out, 'Mama, Mama, Mama!' Now I sing out, 'Mary Ann, Mary Ann, Mary Ann!'" And so they were married. They moved to the West, and we know nothing more about the romance. 15 or 20 years ago, Decoration Day happened to be more like the 4th of July for temperature than like the 30th of May. Twitchell was orator of the day. He pelted his great crowd of old Civil War soldiers for an hour in the biggest church in Hartford, while they mourned and sweltered. Then they marched forth and joined the procession of other wilted old soldiers that were oozing from other churches, and tramped through clouds of dust to the cemetery and began to distribute the flags and the flowers, a tiny flag and a small basket of flowers to each military grave. This industry went on and on and on, everybody breathing dust, for there was nothing else to breathe, everybody streaming with perspiration, everybody tired and wishing it was over. At last there was but one basket of flowers left, only one grave still undecorated. A fiery little major, whose patience was all gone, was shouting, "Corporal Henry Jones, Company C, 14th Connecticut Infantry." No response. Nobody seemed to know where that corporal was buried. The major raised his note a degree or two higher. "Corporal Henry Jones, Company C, 14th Connecticut Infantry. Doesn't anybody know where that man is buried?" No response. Once, twice, three times, he shrieked again, with his temper ever rising higher and higher.
Corporal Henry Jones, Company C, 14th Connecticut Infantry. Doesn't anybody know where that man is buried?
No response. Then he slammed the basket of flowers on the ground and said to Twitchell, "Proceed with the finish." The crowd massed themselves together around Twitchell with uncovered heads, the silence and solemnity interrupted only by subdued sneezings, for these people were buried in the dim cloud of dust. After a pause, Twitchell began an impressive prayer, making it brief to meet the exigencies of the occasion. In the middle of it, he made a pause. The drummer thought he was through and let fly a rub-a-dub-dub, and the little major stormed out, "Stop that drum!" Twitchell tried again. He got almost to the last word safely when somebody trod on a dog and the dog let out a howl of anguish that could be heard beyond the frontier. The major said, "God damn that dog!" And Twitchell said, "Amen." That is, he said it as a finish to his own prayer, but it fell so exactly at the right moment that it seemed to include the major's too. So he felt greatly honored and thanked him. Friday, March 16th, 1906. Schoolmates of 60 years ago, Mary Miller, one of Mr. Clemens's first sweethearts, Artemisia Briggs, another, Mary Lacey, another, Jimmy McDaniel, to whom Mr. Clemens told his first humorous story, Mr. Richmond, Sunday school teacher, afterwards owner of Tom Sawyer's Cave, which is now being ground into cement, Hickman, the showy young captain, Rule Gridley and the sack of flour incident, the 11 Jew boys called 22, George Butler, nephew of Ben Butler, the incident of getting into bed with Will Bowen to catch the measles, and the successful and nearly fatal case which resulted. We will return to those school children of 60 years ago. I recall Mary Miller. She was not my first sweetheart, but I think she was the first one that furnished me a broken heart. I fell in love with her when she was 18 and I was 9, but she scorned me, and I recognized that this was a cold world. I had not noticed that temperature before. I believe I was as miserable as even a grown man could be, but I think that this sorrow did not remain with me long. As I remember it, I soon transferred my worship to Artemisia Briggs, who was a year older than Mary Miller. When I revealed my passion to her, she did not scoff at it. She did not make fun of it. She was very kind and gentle about it, but she was also firm, and said she did not want to be pestered by children. And there was Mary Lacey. She was a schoolmate, but she also was out of my class because of her advanced age. She was pretty wild and determined and independent. She was ungovernable and was considered incorrigible, but that was all a mistake. She married and at once settled down and became in all ways a model matron and was as highly respected as any matron in the town. 4 years ago, she was still living and had been married 50 years. Jimmy McDaniel was another schoolmate. His age and mine about tallied. His father kept the candy shop, and he was the most envied little chap in the town, after Tom Blankenship, Huck Finn. For although we never saw him eating candy, we supposed that it was, nevertheless, his ordinary diet. He pretended that he never ate it and didn't care for it because there was nothing forbidden about it. There was plenty of it, and he could have as much of it as he wanted. Still, there was circumstantial evidence that suggested that he only scorned candy in public to show off, for he had the worst teeth in town. He was the first human being to whom I ever told a humorous story, so far as I can remember. This was about Jim Wolfe and the cats, and I gave him that tale the morning after that memorable episode. I thought he would laugh his remaining teeth out. I had never been so proud and happy before, and I have seldom been so proud and happy since. I saw him 4 years ago when I was out there. He was working in a cigar-making shop. He wore an apron that came down to his knees and a beard that came nearly half as far, and yet it was not difficult for me to recognize him. He had been married 54 years. He had many children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and also even posterity, they all said, thousands. Yet the boy to whom I had told the cat story when we were callow juveniles was still present in that cheerful little old man. Artemisia Briggs got married not long after refusing me. She married Richmond, the stonemason, who was my Methodist Sunday school teacher in the earliest days, and he had one distinction which I envied him. At some time or other, He had hit his thumb with his hammer, and the result was a thumbnail which remained permanently twisted and distorted and curved and pointed like a parrot's beak. I should not consider it an ornament now, I suppose, but it had a fascination for me then, and a vast value, because it was the only one in the town. He was a very kindly and considerate Sunday school teacher, and patient and compassionate, so he was the favorite teacher with us little chaps. In that school they had slender oblong pasteboard blue tickets, each with a verse from the Testament printed on it, and you could get a blue ticket by reciting two verses. By reciting five verses, you could get three blue tickets, and you could trade these at the bookcase and borrow a book for a week. I was under Mr. Richmond's spiritual care every now and then for 2 or 3 years, and he was never hard upon me. I always recited the same five verses every Sunday. He was always satisfied with the performance. He never seemed to notice that these were the same five foolish virgins that he had been hearing about every Sunday for months. I always got my tickets and exchanged them for a book. They were pretty dreary books, for there was not a bad boy in the entire bookcase. They were all good boys and good girls and drearily uninteresting, but they were better society than none, and I was glad to have their company and disapprove of it. 20 years ago, Mr. Richmond had become possessed of Tom Sawyer's cave in the hills, 3 miles from town, and had made a tourist resort of it. But that cave is a thing of the past now. In 1849, when the gold seekers were streaming through our little town of Hannibal, many of our grown men got the gold fever, and I think that all the boys had it. On the Saturday holidays, in summertime, we used to borrow skiffs whose owners were not present and go down the river 3 miles to the cave hollow, Missourian for valley, and there we staked out claims and pretended to dig gold, panning out $0.50 a day at first, 2 or 3 times as much later, and by and by whole fortunes, as our imaginations became inured to the work. Stupid and unprophetic lads, we were doing this in play and never suspecting. Why, that cave hollow and all the adjacent hills were made of gold, but we did not know it. We took it for dirt. We left its rich secret in its own peaceful possession and grew up in poverty and went wandering about the world struggling for bread, and this because we had not the gift of prophecy. That region was all dirt and rocks to us, yet all it needed was to be ground up and scientifically handled, and it was gold. That is to say, the whole region was a cement mine, and they make the finest kind of Portland cement there now, 5,000 barrels a day, with a plant that costs $2 million. Several months ago, a telegram came to me from there saying that Tom Sawyer's cave was now being ground into cement. Would I like to say anything about it in public? But I had nothing to say. I was sorry we lost our cement mine, but it was not worthwhile to talk about it at this late day. And take it all around, it was a painful subject anyway. There are 7 miles of Tom Sawyer's cave. That is to say, the lofty ridge which conceals that cave stretches down the bank of the Mississippi 7 miles to the town of Saverton. For a little while, Rule Gridley attended that school of ours. He was an elderly pupil. He was perhaps 22 or 23 years old. Then came the Mexican War, and he volunteered. A company of infantry was raised in our town, and Mr. Hickman, a tall, straight, handsome athlete of 25, was made captain of it and had a sword by his side and a broad yellow stripe down the leg of his gray pants. And when that company marched back and forth through the streets in its smart uniform, which it did several times a day for drill, its evolutions were attended by all the boys whenever the school hours permitted. I can see that marching company yet, and I can almost feel again the consuming desire that I had to join it. But they had no use for boys of 12 and 13, and before I had a chance in another war, the desire to kill people to whom I had not been introduced had passed away. I saw the splendid Hickman in his old age. He seemed about the oldest man I had ever seen, an amazing and melancholy contrast with the showy young captain I had seen preparing his warriors for carnage so many, many years before. Hickman is dead. It is the old story. As Susie said, what is it all for? Rule Gridley went away to the wars, and we heard of him no more for 15 or 16 years. Then, one day in Carson City, while I was having a difficulty with an editor on the sidewalk, an editor better built for war than I was, I heard a voice say, "Give him the best you've got, Sam. I'm at your back." It was Rule Gridley. He said he had not recognized me by my face, but by my drawling style of speech. He went down to the Reese River mines about that time, and presently he lost an election bet in his mining camp, and by the terms of it he was obliged to buy a 50-pound sack of self-rising flour and carry it through the town, preceded by music, and deliver it to the winner of the bet. Of course, the whole camp was present and full of fluid and enthusiasm. The winner of the bet put up the sack at auction for the benefit of the United States Sanitary Fund and sold it. The purchaser put it up for the fund and sold it. The excitement grew and grew. The sack was sold over and over again for the benefit of the fund. The news of it came to Virginia City by telegraph. It produced great enthusiasm, and Rule Gridley was begged by telegraph to bring the sack and have an auction in Virginia City. He brought it. An open barouche was provided. Also a brass band. The sack was sold over and over again at Gold Hill, then was brought up to Virginia City toward night and sold again and again and still again, netting $20,000 or $30,000 for the sanitary fund. Gridley carried it across California and sold it at various towns. He sold it for large sums in Sacramento and in San Francisco. He brought it east, sold it in New York and in various other cities, then carried it out to a great fair at St. Louis and went on selling it, and finally made it up into small cakes and sold those at $1 apiece. First and last, the sack of flour, which had originally cost $10, perhaps, netted more than $200,000 for the sanitary fund. Rule Gridley has been dead these many, many years. It is the old story. In that school were the first Jews I had ever seen. It took me a good while to get over the awe of it. To my fancy, they were clothed invisibly in the damp and cobwebby mold of antiquity. They carried me back to Egypt, and in imagination I moved among the pharaohs and all the shadowy celebrities of that remote age. The name of the boys was Levin. We had a collective name for them, which was the only really large and handsome witticism that was ever born in that congressional district. We called them 22, and even when the joke was old and had been worn threadbare, we always followed it with the explanation to make sure that it would be understood. Twice 11, 22. There were other boys whose names remain with me, Irving Ayers, but no matter, he is dead. Then there was George Butler, whom I remember as a child of 7 wearing a blue leather belt with a brass buckle, and hated and envied by all the boys on account of it. He was a nephew of General Ben Butler and fought gallantly at Ball's Bluff and in several other actions of the Civil War. He is dead long and long ago. Will Bowen, dead long ago. Ed Stevens, dead long ago. And John Briggs were special mates of mine. John is still living. In 1845, when I was 10 years old, there was an epidemic of measles in the town, and it made a most alarming slaughter among the little people. There was a funeral almost daily, and the mothers of the town were nearly demented with fright. My mother was greatly troubled. She worried over Pamela and Henry and me, and took constant and extraordinary pains to keep us from coming into contact with the contagion. But upon reflection, I believed that her judgment was at fault. It seemed to me that I could improve upon it if left to my own devices. I cannot remember now whether I was frightened about the measles or not, but I clearly remember that I grew very tired of the suspense I suffered on account of being continually under the threat of death. I remember that I got so weary of it and so anxious to have the matter settled one way or the other, and promptly, that this anxiety spoiled my days and my nights. I had no pleasure in them. I made up my mind to end this suspense and be done with it. Will Bowen was dangerously ill with the measles, and I thought I would go down there and catch them. I entered the house by the front way and slipped along through rooms and halls, keeping sharp watch against discovery, and at last I reached Will's bedchamber in the rear of the house on the second floor and got into it uncaptured. But that was as far as my victory reached. His mother caught me there a moment later and snatched me out of the house and gave me a most competent scolding and drove me away. She was so scared that she could hardly get her words out, and her face was white. I saw that I must manage better next time, and I did. I hung about the lane at the rear of the house and watched through cracks in the fence until I was convinced that the conditions were favorable. Then I slipped through the backyard and up the back way and got into the room and into the bed with Will Bowen without being observed. I don't know how long I was in the bed. I only remember that Will Bowen, as society, had no value for me, for he was too sick to even notice that I was there. When I heard his mother coming, I covered up my head, but that device was a failure. It was dead summertime. The cover was nothing more than a limp blanket or sheet, and anybody could see there were two of us under it. It didn't remain too very long. Mrs. Bowen snatched me out of the bed and conducted me home herself, with a grip on my collar which she never loosened, until she delivered me into my mother's hands along with her opinion of that kind of a boy. It was a good case of measles that resulted. It brought me within a shade of death's door. It brought me to where I no longer took any interest in anything, but on the contrary, felt a total absence of interest, which was most placid and tranquil and sweet and delightful and enchanting. I have never enjoyed anything in my life any more than I enjoyed dying that time. I was, in effect, dying. The word had been passed, and the family notified to assemble around the bed and see me off. I knew them all. There was no doubtfulness in my vision. They were all crying, but that did not affect me. I took but the vaguest interest in it, and that merely because I was the center of all this emotional attention and was gratified by it and vain of it. When Dr. Cunningham had made up his mind that nothing more could be done for me, he put bags of hot ashes all over me. He put them on my breast, on my wrists, on my ankles. And so, very much to his astonishment, and doubtless to my regret, he dragged me back into this world and set me going again. Tuesday, March 20th, 1906. About young John D. Rockefeller's Sunday school talks, Mr. Clemens is asked as honorary member to talk to the Bible class. His letter of refusal. He accepts invitation from General Fred Grant to speak at Carnegie Hall April 10th for benefit of Robert Fulton Memorial Association. His letter of acceptance. One of the standing delights of the American nation in these days is John D. Rockefeller, Jr.'s Bible class adventures in theology. Every Sunday, young Rockefeller explains the Bible to his class. The next day, the newspapers and the Associated Press distribute his explanations all over the continent, and everybody laughs. The entire nation laughs, yet in its innocent dullness never suspects that it is laughing at itself. But that is what it is doing. Young Rockefeller, who is perhaps 35 years old, is a plain, simple, earnest, sincere, honest, well-meaning, commonplace person, destitute of originality or any suggestion of it. And if he were traveling upon his mental merit instead of upon his father's money, his explanations of the Bible would fall silent and not be heard of by the public. But his father ranks as the richest man in the world, and this makes his son's theological gymnastics interesting and important. The world believes that the elder Rockefeller is worth $1 billion. He pays taxes on $2.5 million. He is an earnest, uneducated Christian, and for years and years has been admiral of a Sunday school in Cleveland, Ohio. For years and years he has discoursed about himself to his Sunday school and explained how he got his dollars. And during all these years his Sunday school has listened in rapture and has divided its worship between him and his Creator, unequally. His Sunday school talks are telegraphed about the country and are as eagerly read by the nation as are his sons. As I have said, the nation laughs at young Rockefeller's analyzations of the Scriptures. Yet the nation must know that these analyzations are exactly like those which it hears every Sunday from its pulpits and which its forebears have been listening to for centuries without a change of an idea, in case an idea has ever occurred in one of these discourses. Young John's methods are the ordinary pulpit methods. His deductions of golden fancy from sordid fact are exactly the same which the pulpit has traded in for centuries. Every argument he uses was already worn threadbare by the theologians of all the ages before it came in its rags to him. All his reasonings are like all the reasonings of all the pulpit's stale borrowings from the dull pulpits of the centuries. Young John has never studied a doctrine for himself. He has never examined a doctrine upon its real merits. He has never examined a doctrine for any purpose but to make it fit the notions which he got at second hand from his teachers. His talks are quite as original and quite as valuable as any that proceed from any other theologian's lips, from the Pope of Rome down to himself. The nation laughs at young John's profound and clumsy examinations of Joseph's character and conduct. Yet the nation has always heard Joseph's character and conduct examined in the same clumsy and stupid way by its pulpits, and the nation should reflect that when they laugh at young John, they are laughing at themselves. They should reflect that young John is using no new whitewash upon Joseph. He is using the same old brush and the same old whitewash that have made Joseph grotesque in all the centuries. I have known and liked young John for many years, and I have long felt that his right place was in the pulpit. I am sure that the foxfire of his mind would make a proper glow there, but I suppose he must do his destiny as decreed and succeed his father as master of the colossal Standard Oil Corporation. One of his most delightful theological deliverances was his exposition 3 years ago of the meaning, the real meaning, the bottom meaning, of Christ's admonition to the young man who was overburdened with wealth yet wanted to save himself if a convenient way could be found. Sell all thou hast and give to the poor. Young John reasoned it out to this effect. Whatever thing stands between you and salvation, remove that obstruction at any cost. If it is money, give it away to the poor. If it is property, sell the whole of it and give the proceeds to the poor. If it is military ambition, retire from the service. If it is an absorbing infatuation for any person or thing or pursuit, fling it far from you and proceed with a single mind to achieve your salvation. The inference was plain. Young John's father's millions and his own were a mere incident in their lives and not in any way an obstruction in their pursuit of salvation. Therefore, Christ's admonition could have no application to them. One of the newspapers sent interviewers to 6 or 7 New York clergymen to get their views upon this matter, with this result, that all of them except one agreed with young Rockefeller. I do not know what we should do without the pulpit. We could better spare the sun. The moon, anyway. 3 years ago, I went with young John to his Bible class and talked to it. Not theologically, that would not have been in good taste, and I prefer good taste to righteousness. Now, whoever, on the outside, goes there and talks to that Bible class is by that act entitled to honorary membership in it. Therefore, I am an honorary member. Some days ago, a Bible class official sent me word that there would be a quinquennial meeting of these honoraries in their church day after tomorrow evening, and it was desired that I should come there and help do the talking. If I could not come, would I send a letter which could be read to those people? I was already overburdened with engagements, so I sent my regrets and the following letter. March 14, 1906. Mr. Edward M. Foote, Chairman. Dear friend and fellow member. Indeed, I should like to attend the reunion of the Fellowship of Honorary Members of Mr. Rockefeller's Bible Class, of whom I am one by grace of service rendered. But I must be discreet and not venture. This is on account of Joseph. He might come up as an issue, and then I could get into trouble. For Mr. Rockefeller and I do not agree as to Joseph. 8 years ago, I quite painstakingly and exhaustively explained Joseph by the light of the 47th chapter of Genesis in a North American Review article which has since been transferred to volume 22 of my collected works. Then I turned my attention to other subjects under the impression that I had settled Joseph for good and all and left nothing further for anybody to say about him. Judge, then, of my surprise and sorrow when by the newspapers I lately saw that Mr. Rockefeller had taken hold of Joseph, quite manifestly unaware that I had already settled Joseph and was trying to settle him again. In every sentence uttered by Mr. Rockefeller there was evidence that he was not acquainted with Joseph. Therefore it was plain to me that he had never read my article. He has certainly not read it, because his published estimate of Joseph differs from mine. This could not be if he had read the article. He thinks Joseph was Mary's little lamb. This is an error. But you look at the article, then you will see what he was. For ages, Joseph has been a most delicate and difficult problem. That is for everybody but me. It is because I examine him on the facts as they stand recorded. The other theologians don't. Overborne by a sense of duty, they paint the facts. They paint some of them clear out. Paint them out and paint some better ones in, which they get out of their own imaginations. They make up a Joseph statement on the plan of the statement which a shaky bank gets up for the beguilement of the bank inspector. They spirit away light-throwing liabilities and insert fanciful assets in their places. Am I saying the thing that isn't true? Sunday before last, the very learned and able Dr. Silverman was thus reported in the Times. But the farmers, the agriculturists, and the shepherds, who depended for their living on the product of the land, suffered most during a famine. To prevent utter starvation, Joseph had the people from the country removed to the cities, from one end of the borders of Egypt even to the other end thereof. Genesis chapter 47, verse 21. And there he supported them. As long as they had money, he gave them food for money. But when this was exhausted, he took their cattle, their horses, their herds and asses, and even their land, when necessary, as a pledge for food. The government then fed the cattle, horses, etc., which otherwise would have died. Later, the land, the ownership, was returned to the former owners. They were given seed to sow the land. They received as many of their cattle, horses, herds, etc., as they needed, and in payment were only required to give the government 1/5 part of all their increase in animals or produce. The whole plan of Joseph was statesmanlike, as well as humanitarian. It appealed at once to Pharaoh and his counselors, and it is no wonder that Joseph was appointed viceroy of all Egypt. Joseph successfully combated all the human sharks and speculators who had for years despoiled the poor in the season of famine and reduced them to starvation and beggary. He held the land and animals of the needy as pledge and then returned them their patrimony. The ownership? He charged them only a fair market price for the food they received. Without the wise institutions of public storehouses which Joseph had erected, the people would have lost all their possessions, the whole country would have been reduced to misery, and thousands upon thousands would have died, as had been the case in previous seasons of famine. That is Dr. Silverman's bank statement, all painted and gilded and ready for the inspector. This is the Bible's statement. The italics are mine. And there was no bread in all the land, for the famine was very sore, so that the land of Egypt and all the land of Canaan fainted by reason of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all, italicized, of the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the corn which they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. And when money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all, italicized, the Egyptians came unto Joseph and said, "Give us bread, for why should we die in thy presence? For the money faileth." And Joseph said, "Give your cattle, and I will give you for your cattle if money fail." And they brought their cattle unto Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for horses, and for the flocks, and for the cattle of the herds, and for the asses. And he fed them with bread for all their cattle, italicized, that year. When that year was ended, they came unto him the second year, and said unto him, "We will not hide it from my lord, how that our money is spent. My lord also hath our herds of cattle. There is not aught left, italicized, in the sight of my lord, but our bodies and our lands, italicized. Wherefore shall we die before thine eyes, both we and our land? By us, italicized, and our land, italicized, for bread, and we and our land will be servants unto Pharaoh, and give us seed that we may live and not die, that the land be not desolate." And Joseph bought, italicized, all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. For the Egyptians sold, italicized, every man his field, because the famine prevailed over them. So the land became Pharaoh's, italicized. And as for the people, he removed them to cities from one end of the borders of Egypt, even to the other end thereof. Only the land of the priests bought he not. For the priests had a portion assigned them of Pharaoh, and did eat their portion which Pharaoh gave them, wherefore they sold not their lands. Then Joseph said unto the people, "Behold, I have bought you, italicized, this day, and your land, italicized, for Pharaoh. Lo, here is seed for you, and ye shall sow the land. And it shall come to pass in the increase, that ye shall give the fifth part unto Pharaoh, and four parts shall be your own, for seed of the field, and for your own food, and for them of your households, and for food for your little ones." And they said, "Thou hast saved our lives. Let us find grace in the sight of my lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants." And Joseph made it a law over the land of Egypt unto this day, that Pharaoh shall have the fifth part, except the land of the priests only, which became not Pharaoh's. I do not find anything there about a pledge. It looks to me like a brand new asset for Joseph, and a most handsome and ameliorating one, too, if a body could find some kind of authority for it, but I can't find it. I do not find that Joseph made loans to those distressed peasants and secured the loans by mortgage on their lands and animals. I seem to find that he took the land itself to the last acre, and the animals, too, to the last hoof. and I do not get the impression that Joseph charged those starving unfortunates only a fair market price for the food they received. No, I get the impression that he skinned them of every last penny they had, of every last acre they had, of every last animal they had, then bought the whole nation's bodies and liberties on a fair market valuation for bread and the chains of slavery. Is it conceivable that there can be a fair market price, or any price whatever, estimable in gold or diamonds or banknotes or government bonds, for a man's supremest possession, that one possession without which his life is totally worthless, his liberty? Joseph acted handsome by the clergy. It is the most I can say for him. Politic, too. They haven't forgotten it yet. No, I thank you cordially and in all sincerity, but I am afraid to come. I must not venture to come, for I am sensitive, I am humane, I am tender in my feelings, and I could not bear it if young Mr. Rockefeller, whom I think a great deal of, should get up and go to whitewashing Joseph again. But you have my very best wishes. Mark Twain, Honorary Member of the Bible Class. I sent that letter privately to young John himself and asked him to make himself perfectly free with it, and please suppress it if it seemed to him improper matter to be read in a church. He suppressed it, which shows that he has a level Standard Oil head notwithstanding his theology. Then he asked me to go to the meeting of honoraries and talk, and said I might choose my own subject and talk freely. He suggested a subject which he had been experimenting with himself before his Bible class a couple of months ago, lying. The subject suited me very well. I had read the newspaper reports of his discourse and had perceived that he was like all the other pulpits. He knew nothing valuable about lying, that like all other pulpits he imagines that there has been somebody upon this planet, at some time or other, who was not a liar, that he imagines like all other pulpits. However, I have treated this matter in one of my books, and it is not necessary to treat it again in this place. It was agreed that young John is to call at the house day after tomorrow evening and take me to his church, I to be free to talk about lying, if I like, or talk upon some freshly interesting subject instead, in case there should be a person there capable of starting a fresh subject in such an atmosphere. But after all, I can't go. I am fighting off my annual bronchitis, and the doctor has forbidden it. I am sorry, for I am sure I know more about lying than anybody who has lived on this planet before me. I believe I am the only person alive who is sane upon this subject. I have been familiar with it for 70 years. The first utterance I ever made was a lie, for I pretended that a pin was sticking me, whereas it was not so. I have been interested in this great art ever since. I have practiced it ever since, sometimes for pleasure, usually for profit. And to this day I do not always know when to believe myself and when to take the matter under consideration. I shall be unspeakably sorry if the bronchitis catches me, for that will mean 6 weeks in bed, my annual tribute to it for the last 16 years. I shall be sorry because I want to be in condition to appear at Carnegie Hall on the night of April 10th and take my permanent leave of the platform. I never intend to lecture for pay again, and I think I shall never lecture again where the audience has paid to get in. I shall go on talking, but it will be for fun, not money. I can get lots of it to do. My first appearance before an audience was 40 years ago in San Francisco. If I live to take my farewell in Carnegie Hall on the night of the 10th, I shall see, and see constantly, what no one else in that house will see. I shall see two vast audiences, the San Francisco audience of 40 years ago and the one which will be before me at that time. I shall see that early audience with as absolute distinctness in every detail as I see it at this moment, and as I shall see it while looking at the Carnegie audience. I am promising myself a consuming pleasure on that Carnegie night, and I hope that the bronchitis will leave me alone and let me enjoy it. I was vaguely meditating a farewell stunt when General Fred Grant sent a gentleman over here a week ago to offer me $1,000 to deliver a talk for the benefit of the Robert Fulton Memorial Association, of which he is the president and I vice president. This was the very thing, and I accepted at once and said I would without delay write some telegrams and letters from Fred Grant to myself and sign his name to them, and I would answer those telegrams and letters and sign my name to them, and in this way we would make a good advertisement, and I could thus get the fact before the public that I was now delivering my last and final platform talk for money. I wrote the correspondence at once. General Grant approved it, and I here insert it. Private and confidential. Correspondence. Telegram. Headquarters, Department of the East, Governor's Island, New York. Mark Twain, New York. Would you consider a proposal to talk at Carnegie Hall for the benefit of the Robert Fulton Memorial Association, of which you are a vice president, for a fee of $1,000? F.D. Grant, President, Fulton Memorial Association. Telegraphic answer. Major General F.D. Grant, Headquarters, Department of the East, Governor's Island, New York. I shall be glad to do it, but I must stipulate that you keep the $1,000 and add it to the memorial fund as my contribution. Clemens. Letters. Dear Mr. Clemens, you have the thanks of the association, and the terms shall be as you say. But why give all of it? Why not reserve a portion? Why should you do this work wholly without compensation? Truly yours, Fred D. Grant. Major General Grant, Headquarters Department of the East. Dear General, because I stopped talking for pay a good many years ago, and I could not resume the habit now without a great deal of personal discomfort. I love to hear myself talk because I get so much instruction and moral upheaval out of it, but I lose the bulk of this joy when I charge for it. Let the terms stand. General, if I have your approval, I wish to use this good occasion to retire permanently from the platform. Truly yours, S. L. Clemens. Dear Mr. Clemens, certainly, but as an old friend, permit me to say, don't do that. Why should you? You are not old yet. Yours truly, Fred D. Grant. Dear General, I mean the pay platform. I shan't retire from the gratis platform until after I am dead, and courtesy requires me to keep still and not disturb the others. What shall I talk about? My idea is this, to instruct the audience about Robert Fulton and... Tell me, was that his real name, or was it his nom de plume? However, never mind, it is not important. I can skip it, and the house will think I knew all about it, but forgot. Could you find out for me if he was one of the signers of the Declaration, and which one? But if it is any trouble, let it alone, I can skip it. Was he out with Paul Jones? Will you ask Horace Porter? And ask him if he brought both of them home. These will be very interesting facts if they can be established. But never mind, don't trouble Porter, I can establish them anyway. The way I look at it, they are historical gems, gems of the very first water. Well, that is my idea, as I have said. First, excite the audience with a spoonful of information about Fulton, then quiet them down with a barrel of illustration drawn by memory from my books. And if you don't say anything, the house will think they never heard of it before, because people don't really read your books, they only say they do to keep you from feeling bad. Next, excite the house with another spoonful of Fultonian fact. Then tranquilize them again with another barrel of illustration. And so on, all through the evening. And if you are discreet, and don't tell them the illustrations don't illustrate anything, they won't notice it, and I will send them home as well informed about Robert Fulton as I am myself. Don't you be afraid. I know all about audiences. They believe everything you say, except when you are telling the truth. Truly yours, S. L. Clemens. P.S. Mark all the advertisements private and confidential, otherwise the people will not read them. M.T. Dear Mr. Clemens, how long shall you talk? I ask in order that we may be able to say when carriages may be called. Very truly yours, Hugh Gordon Miller, Secretary. Dear Mr. Miller, I cannot say for sure. It is my custom to keep on talking till I get the audience cowed. Sometimes it takes an hour and 15 minutes. Sometimes I can do it in an hour. Sincerely yours, S. L. Clemens. Memorandum. My charge is 2 boxes free. Not the choicest. Sell the choicest. And give me any 6-seat boxes you please. S. L. C. I want Fred Grant, in uniform, on the stage. Also the rest of the officials of the association. Also other distinguished people. All the attractions we can get. Also a seat for Mr. Albert Bigelow Payne, who may be useful to me if he is near me and on the front. SLC. Private and confidential. At Carnegie Hall, put in the date, Mr. Mark Twain will take permanent leave, very large, of the platform, very small type. Proceeds to go to the Robert Fulton Memorial Fund. Tickets, blank dollars, obtainable at blank and at blank. Boxes will be sold by auction at blank on date. Instrumental music preceding the talk. At 8:40, intermission of 10 minutes. Wednesday, March 21st, 1906. Mental telegraphy, Letter from Mr. Jock Brown. Search for Dr. John Brown's letters a failure. Mr. Twitchell and his wife Harmony have an adventure in Scotland. Mr. Twitchell's picture of a military execution. Letter relating to foundation of the Players Club. The mismanagement which caused Mr. Clemens to be expelled from the club. He is now an honorary member. Certainly mental telegraphy is an industry which is always silently at work, oftener than otherwise, perhaps, when we are not suspecting that it is affecting our thought. A few weeks ago, when I was dictating something about Dr. John Brown of Edinburgh and our pleasant relations with him during 6 weeks there, and his pleasant relations with our little child, Susie, he had not been in my mind for a good while, a year perhaps, but he has often been in my mind since, and his name has been frequently upon my lips and as frequently falling from the point of my pen. About a fortnight ago, I began to plan an article about him and about Marjorie Fleming, whose first biographer he was, and yesterday I began the article. Today comes a letter from his son, Jock, from whom I had not previously heard for a good many years. He has been engaged in collecting his father's letters for publication. This labor would naturally bring me into his mind with some frequency, and I judged that his mind telegraphed his thoughts to me across the Atlantic. I imagine that we get most of our thoughts out of somebody else's head by mental telegraphy, and not always out of heads of acquaintances, but, in the majority of cases, out of the heads of strangers. Strangers far removed, Chinamen, Hindus, and all manner of remote foreigners, whose language we should not be able to understand, but whose thoughts we can read without difficulty. 7 Greenhill Place, Edinburgh, 8th of March, 1906. Dear Mr. Clemens, I hope you remember me, Jock, son of Dr. John Brown. At my father's death, I handed to Dr. J.T. Brown all the letters I had to my father, as he intended to write his life, being his cousin and lifelong friend. He did write a memoir, published after his death in 1901, but he made no use of the letters, and it was little more than a critique of his writings. If you care to see it, I shall send it. Among the letters which I got back in 1902 were some from you and Mrs. Clemens. I have now got a large number of letters written by my father between 1830 and 1882, and intend publishing a selection in order to give the public an idea of the man he was. This I think they will do. Miss E.T. McLaren is to add the necessary notes. I now write to ask you if you have letters from him, and if you will let me see them and use them. I enclose letters from yourself and Mrs. Clemens, which I should like to use, 15 sheets typewritten. Though I did not write as I should to you on the death of Mrs. Clemens, I was very sorry to hear of it through the papers, and as I now read these letters, she rises before me, gentle and lovable as I knew her. I do hope you will let me use her letter. It is most beautiful. I also hope you will let me use yours. I am yours very sincerely, John Brown. We have searched for Dr. John's letters, but without success. I do not understand this. There ought to be a good many, and none should be missing, for Mrs. Clemens held Dr. John in such love and reverence that his letters were sacred things in her eyes, and she preserved them and took watchful care of them. During our 10 years' absence in Europe, many letters and like memorials became scattered and lost, but I think it unlikely that Dr. John's have suffered this fate. I think we shall find them yet. These thoughts about Jock bring me back to the Edinburgh of 33 years ago, and the thought of Edinburgh brings to my mind one of Reverend Joe Twitchell's adventures. A quarter of a century ago, Twitchell and Harmony, his wife, visited Europe for the first time and made a stay of a day or two in Edinburgh. They were devotees of Scott, and they devoted that day or two to ransacking Edinburgh for things and places made sacred by contact with the magician of the north. Toward midnight, on the second night, they were returning to their lodgings on foot. A dismal and steady rain was falling, and by consequence they had George Street all to themselves. Presently the rainfall became so heavy that they took refuge from it in a deep doorway, and there in the black darkness they discussed with satisfaction all the achievements of the day. Then Joe said, "It has been hard work and a heavy strain on the strength, but we have our reward. There isn't a thing connected with Scott in Edinburgh that we haven't seen or touched, not one. I mean the things a stranger could have access to. There is one we haven't seen, but it's not accessible. a private collection of relics and memorials of Scott of great interest. But I do not know where it is. I can't get on the track of it. I wish we could, but we can't. We've got to give the idea up. It would be a grand thing to have a sight of that collection, Harmony. A voice out of the darkness said, "Come upstairs, and I will show it to you." And the voice was as good as its word. The voice belonged to the gentleman who owned the collection. He took Joe and Harmony upstairs, fed them and refreshed them, and while they examined the collection, he chatted and explained. When they left at 2 in the morning, they realized that they had had the star time of their trip. Joe has always been on hand when anything was going to happen, except once. He got delayed in some unaccountable way, or he would have been blown up at Petersburg when the mined defenses of that place were flung heavenward in the Civil War. When I was in Hartford the other day, he told me about another of his long string of providential opportunities. I think he thinks Providence is always looking out for him when interesting things are going to happen. This was the execution of some deserters during the Civil War. When we read about such things in history, we always have one and the same picture. Blindfolded men kneeling with their heads bowed. A file of stern and alert soldiers fronting them with their muskets ready. An austere officer in uniform standing apart who gives sharp, terse orders. "Make ready! Take aim! Fire!" There is a belch of flame and smoke. The victims fall forward, expiring. The file shoulders arms, wheels, marches erect and stiff-legged off the field, and the incident is closed. Joe's picture is different, and I suspect that it is the true one, the common one. In this picture, the deserters requested that they might be allowed to stand, not kneel, that they might not be blindfolded, but permitted to look the firing file in the eye. Their request was granted. They stood erect and soldierly. They kept their color. They did not blench. Their eyes were steady. But these things could not be said of any other person present. A general of brigade sat upon his horse white-faced, white as a corpse. The officer commanding the squad was white-faced, white as a corpse. The firing file were white-faced, and their forms wobbled so that the wobble was transmitted to their muskets when they took aim. The officer of the squad could not command his voice, and his tone was weak and poor, not brisk and stern. When the file had done its deadly work, it did not march away martially erect and stiff-legged. It wobbled. This picture commends itself to me as being the truest one that anyone has yet furnished of a military execution. In searching for Dr. Brown's letters, a failure, we have made a find which we were not expecting. Evidently it marks the foundation of the Players' Club, and so it has value for me. Daly's Theater, under the management of Augustine Daly, Manager's Office, New York, January 2, 1888. Mr. Augustine Daly will be very much pleased to have Mr. S. L. Clemens meet Mr. Booth, Mr. Barrett, and Mr. Palmer, and a few friends at lunch on Friday, next January 6th, at 1 o'clock in Delmonico's, to discuss the formation of a new club which it is thought will claim your interest. RSVP. All the founders, I think, were present at that luncheon, among them Booth, Barrett, Palmer, General Sherman, Bispham, Aldrich, and the rest. I do not recall the other names. I think Lawrence Hutton states in one of his books that the club's name, the Players, had been already selected and accepted before this luncheon took place, but I take that to be a mistake. I remember that several names were proposed, discussed, and abandoned at the luncheon, that finally Thomas Bailey Aldrich suggested that compact and simple name, the Players, and that even that happy title was not immediately accepted. However, the discussion was very brief. The objections to it were easily routed and driven from the field, and the vote in its favor was unanimous. I lost my interest in the club 3 years ago, for cause, but it has lately returned to me, to my great satisfaction. Mr. Booth's bequest was a great and generous one, but he left 2. The other one was not much of a benefaction. It was McGonagall, a foolish old relative of his who needed a support. As secretary, he governed the club and its board of managers like an autocrat from the beginning until 3 or 4 months ago, when he retired from his position superannuated. From the beginning, I left my dues and costs to be paid by my business agent in Hartford, Mr. Whitmore. He attended to all business of mine. I interested myself in none of it. When we went to Europe in 91, I left a written order in the secretary's office continuing Whitmore in his function of paymaster of my club dues. Nothing happened until a year had gone by. Then a bill for dues reached me in Europe. I returned it to McGonagall and reminded him of my order, which had not been changed. Then for a couple of years the bills went to Whitmore, after which a bill came to me in Europe. I returned it with the previous remarks repeated. But about every 2 years the sending of bills to me would be resumed. I sent them back with the usual remarks. Twice the bills were accompanied by offensive letters from the secretary. These I answered profanely. At last we came home in 1901. No bills came to me for a year. Then we took a residence at Riverdale on the Hudson, and straightway came a player's bill for dues. I was a weary, and I put it in the wastebasket. 10 days later the bill came again, and with it a shadowy threat. I wastebasketed it. After another 10 days the bill came once more, and this time the threat was in a concreted condition. It said very peremptorily that if the bill were not paid within a week I would be expelled from the club and posted as a delinquent. This went the way of its predecessors into the wastebasket. On the named day I was expelled and posted, and I was much gratified, for I was tired of being McGonagalled every little while. Robert Reed, David Monroe, and other special friends in the club were astonished and put themselves in communication with me to find out what this strange thing meant. I explained to them. They wanted me to state the case to the management and require a reconsideration of the decree of expulsion, but I had to decline that proposition. And therefore things remained as they were until a few months ago when the McGonagall retired from the autocracy. The boys thought that my return to the club would be plain and simple sailing now, but I thought differently. I was no longer a member. I could not become a member without consenting to be voted for like any other candidate, and I would not do that. The management had expelled me upon the mere statement of a clerk that I was a delinquent. Neither they nor the clerk could know whether I ever received those bills and threats or not, since they had been transmitted by the mail. They had not asked me to testify in my defense. Their books would show that I had never failed to pay, and pay promptly. They might properly argue from that I had not all of a sudden become a rascal, and that I might be able to explain the situation if asked. The board's whole proceeding had been like all the board's proceedings from the beginning, arbitrary, insolent, stupid. That board's proper place from the beginning was the idiot asylum. I could not allow myself to be voted for again, because from my view of the matter I had never lawfully and legitimately ceased to be a member. However, when Providence disposed of McGonagall, a way fair and honorable to all concerned was easily found to bridge the separating crack. I was made an honorary member, and I've been glad to resume business at the old stand.